of public health systems being eroded. We are the only healthcare system that guarantees healthcare for undocumented immigrants. And so to continue these policies that will exacerbate our staffing crisis, will demoralize our nurses, will, if we're going to set up a healthcare system.
We have 10 seconds.
If we're going to set up a healthcare system in the wake of this crisis, our sacrifice needs to be respected, and we need to be able to recruit and retain a robust healthcare staff after this crisis is over. So
we have to leave it there, Sean. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Sean Petty, registered nurse in the Pediatric Emergency Room, Public Hospital in the Bronx, member of the Board of Directors of the New York State Nurses Association. I want to end with this tweet from Congressmember Ayanna Pressley, who wrote, "Went to get a replacement inhaler today, told me generic is sold out with a wait list, so my only option is one that costs $175. My copay for the other is $10. I can afford the increase, but millions won't be able to. Literally, what folks need to breathe, live, is political," she said. That does it for our show. You can sign up for our Daily Digest every day. Get the quarantine report in your email. Text the words Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. Or you can go to our website at democracynow.org and sign up there. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people as possible on site, the majority of our remarkable team working from home. We thank all of you, and special thanks to General Manager Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Be safe.
Hey, KBOO supporters, this is Kat Miao, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our...
in medicine at Harvard Medical School. And we turn our attention to Julian Assange, who is under threat of extradition to the United States. We speak with London-based Deepa Driver. She is a citizen activist campaigning to free WikiLeaks publisher and multi-award-winning journalist Julian Assange. Also, we take a look at the impact of the protests against the World Bank and the IMF and the broader implications of today. Those protests took place in April of 2000. Our guest is Soren Ambrose, International Head of Policy, Advocacy, and Research for Action Aid International. He's based in Nairobi, Kenya, but he was one of the lead organizers of the April 2000 protests against the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and World Bank, which brought upwards of 20,000 people to Washington, D.C. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. What I'd like to do now is we're going to continue our coverage of COVID-19, and we would like to welcome our guest, and let us see if we have our clip ready for that. I don't think we do, but what I'd like to do is to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Dr. David Hammelstein, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the City University of New York, a lecturer in medicine at Harvard Medical Doctor in the Bronx. Dr. Hammelstein co-founded Physicians for a National Health Program, a group whose 23,000 members advocate for Medicare for all. So, Dr. Hammelstein, we're glad to have you back again. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
For joining us. Okay,
thank you.
So, you know, a lot has happened since we last spoke. Increasingly, you heard in our news headlines, the death toll going up. In California alone has over 26,000 cases. Deaths a lot lower than New York, 850 deaths. We are seeing, according to the CDC, about 9,200 healthcare workers are infected. And indeed, a colleague of mine who is a nurse, I just got the sad news yesterday that she has now been diagnosed with it. And on Wednesday, protests by nurses in New York, Massachusetts, Michigan, Illinois, California, Pennsylvania took place. So, Donald Trump is to announce today the guidelines, new measures, and leading to the opening up of the country. But a lot of experts are saying that much wider testing is needed. And in the United States, there's been a huge problem with testing. What are your thoughts on this? Do you agree that widespread testing is needed? And why do you think that hasn't happened?
Well, it's clear we're flying blind in this epidemic. We don't really know how many people are infected. And frankly, we don't really know how many people have died from this illness. In New York City, the number of people dying at home has skyrocketed. And those aren't counted generally as COVID deaths. So there are almost certainly many more deaths than the official figures are telling us. There are many more people infected than the official figures are saying, and we don't know the extent of this epidemic. And without knowing that, it's sheer folly to say that we're going to pull back on the measures needed to try and slow down the epidemic. And the reason we don't know is because we've had completely inadequate tests. We just have not been doing the kind of testing that's needed to understand where we are in this epidemic.
There have been 3.1 million tests, at least as of Tuesday night, given. And in many places, in fact, probably everywhere, you have to have symptoms to be eligible to take the test. However, it has been found that people who don't have symptoms are actually spreading the virus to others. They may not know that they have it, and they're spreading it to others. So how are we really going to know how many people have it, or even how many people have died from it, and what steps have to be taken to reopen the economy?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Dr. Hammelstein.
That's exactly right. And we're also finding out that some of the tests are giving us false negatives. So some people who we do a repeat test and we find that the second test is positive when the first one wasn't, and we've done the repeat test because someone has typical symptoms and X-ray picture, and we think, gee, this is probably a case and the test was wrong, and it turns out some of those early tests were wrong. So when we say 3 million tests, that doesn't even necessarily mean that 3 million people have been tested, because some people have gotten more than one test, and as time goes on, many people are going to need more than one test. because you're negative today doesn't mean you're going to be negative a month from now. So we need to ramp up the availability of tests so that asymptomatic people can get it, and it's freely available to anyone with symptoms. And we're not even close to that at this point. And then, we need contact tracing and isolation on a scale that we're not close to in this country. Massachusetts has just been ramping up its contact tracing effort. They're putting in the field 1,000 people to do the contact tracing in that relatively small state. I think it's 5 or 6 million people in the state. The CDC only has 600 or 700 people to do contact tracing for the federal government. So we need many tens of thousands of people, actually, and there are lots of unemployed people out there who could be hired on to do this work, to do the contact tracing that's key to really controlling an epidemic like this.
So this is a move then that the states can make, because Donald Trump is saying on the testing issue, well, it's not up to us. It's up to the states to do the testing. The states are saying, well, we don't have the tests. So it may be, if the states have the funding, that they can go ahead and hire people to do the kind of contact testing you're talking about, like Massachusetts. And I'm wondering if, you know, just to underscore that point, if you think that is at this point what needs to happen. Of course, the states would need to get the funding to do it. But why do you think it is that in South Korea, for example, they were able to do much wider testing than the United States? I mean, what happened there?
Well, the government mobilized there, and our federal government didn't mobilize. And, you know, it's great that the states are trying to do what they can now. Tax revenues are plummeting in states around this country, and their expenses are going up at the same time. So their resources are limited, and states can't run deficits in their budgets. They're not allowed to. The federal government can basically not just run a deficit, but can print money if it needs to. So ultimately, we need the federal government to step up to get this done, and it needs to step up both in terms of getting the tests available to the states and in putting up the money to do the public health work that's needed to control the epidemic. So even that Massachusetts effort, which is, I think, is clearly going to strain that state, needs federal support, needs federal help. So the reason Korea was able to slow the epidemic quite dramatically is because they put together a real government-funded and directed effort. And some other countries are also doing quite well in this. Australia, for instance, has done considerably better, I understand, than the U.S., and the federal government there has really helped coordinate things and has amped up testing much, much faster than in the U.S. And we have several examples of other nations that have mobilized when ours hasn't.
Dr. David Himmelstein, I mean, I live in Los Angeles. I'm based out of California. And, you know, California is being held up as, well, we are doing so great with the social distancing. I'm sure that that has had an impact. But the reality is that there hasn't been widespread testing in California. I don't know if you have seen, I mean, I haven't seen figures about deaths happening in California, and if there's any difference with the same period, you know, the last few years, as opposed to what's happening now. I mean, we don't know if we're in a situation where people are getting ill and dying from COVID-19, but just because they didn't die in a hospital, so to speak, that it's not being registered. And then the other issue has to do with people who are dying in nursing homes and how many of them are being registered. Do you know what I mean? Like if California, for example, is going to reopen and people are going to be back out on the streets and people have no idea if they're carriers of the virus, if they've had it, if perhaps they may have immunity, because the immunity question is one that is still open. I mean, people think if you've had it, you will get immunity to getting it again, but that's also not definite. Dr. Hammelstein, your view on all these?
You're exactly right, and I don't know of any California figures, and we've just seen some very bare figures from New York. New York had a big jump in its estimate of how many people had died from COVID because they broadened the definition beyond people who had a positive test, but I don't think even in New York we have a good handle on it. What we do know is that in New York City, the number of people dying at home was reported to have jumped from 100 a week to 400 a week. So our best guess is that 300 of those people dying at home each week were probably COVID-related deaths, but we don't know for sure. We do know similar things were going on in northern Italy, where only about 40 or 50% of the total deaths from COVID seemed to be registered as officially as deaths in hospitals from COVID. So it'll take us quite a while to really know what the death rate from this pandemic is, even in developed nations like the U.S. But I think we can confidently say at this point that it's much higher than the official figures. And it'll take us until we have tests to know how many people have been infected, and it'll take a while before we know whether having been infected protects you against getting infected again. We've seen some disturbing reports of cases in Korea where people recovered apparently from COVID virus and tested negative and then subsequently again tested positive. We're not sure, that's just a few cases, whether that's that the test was wrong initially or whether they lacked immunity for some reason. But it'll take us a while to sort this out. And again, testing both for the virus and for the immune system's response to the virus is going to be the key guide to help us understand what's going on and developing strategies for what needs to be done.
Yeah, so testing is an issue. Equipment, another issue. There was a lot of talk about ventilators before, but now there still seems to be a shortage of masks. And indeed, in Santa Monica in Southern California at Providence St. John's Health Center, there were some nurses who were suspended because they refused to care for COVID patients without an N95 mask. And in fact, some of them said, well, how come the doctors have N95 masks and that the nurses don't? And as I said earlier, there were protests on Wednesday by nurses in several states, including California, Michigan, Massachusetts, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania. So your thought on this in terms of frontline workers like nurses having to do this work or being mandated to do this work without the N95 mask?
Well, I mean, our country has been not just poorly prepared, but unprepared, and the government has been incompetent in helping with this, and the result has been that health workers are put in untenable conditions, and it's not just doctors and nurses, it's cleaning personnel and the nursing aides and assistants who are working in hospitals, and frankly, in nursing homes, we may have the worst situations for the personnel, and most of the people working there are the lowest paid workers, many of them immigrants, and a few RNs, few registered nurses working in nursing homes, but mostly we're talking about nursing aides and others who are the lowest paid folks in the healthcare system. So we just have not had the supplies available to protect people. For the hospitals and nursing homes that have been able to get those supplies, they need to be distributed not according to the rank of the personnel, but according to the the risks that those personnel are taking. So no reason doctors should get precedence over nurses when nurses are in there doing the suctioning of patients and attending to the ventilators, in many cases even more than the doctors. But on the other hand, I think it's important to say that we need to take care of patients, even if it is a risk to people. I have a daughter who is at the moment helping to run an ICU for COVID patients in Boston, and they have had a lack of adequate N95 masks, not just for the nurses but for the doctors there. And it's a Hobson's choice or whatever analogy you want to make. We need heroic people willing to do that care, and our health system needs to step up to take care of those people, not only with masks and protective equipment, but, you know, there are a whole lot of frontline health workers who don't have sick leave. And hospitals, most hospitals are exempt from the congressional requirement that they provide sick leave because the Congress exempted employers with more than 500 people, and most hospitals employ more than 500 people at this point. So there are lots of hospital workers at risk, without protective equipment, without sick leave, and particularly in nursing homes and home care workers, many of them don't even have health insurance themselves. So overall, the health workforce has not been protected in any way from this epidemic, and for a generation.
That is just absolutely shocking and outrageous. And that brings us there. Two things I do want to ask you about before we have to wrap up. One has to do with the cutting of funding to the World Health Organization by the Trump administration. I mean, the World Health Organization, it's a huge bureaucracy. When you have a huge bureaucracy, there are bound to be all kinds of issues. But I just wanted your thoughts on the implications of that, particularly for countries in the Global South that very much depend on support and help from the World Health Organization. But also, coming out, I mean, after COVID, life after COVID, things cannot, it seems to many of us, go back to how they were, especially, but not only, when it comes to healthcare and access to healthcare and things like sick leave and recognition of the importance of caring work, whether it's in the home or in the community, wage or unwage. So just your thoughts on those two things, on world health and coming out of this. What do you think that should be in place, Dr. David Himmelstein?
Well, I think we may well look back on this decision to cut the funding for the World Health Organization as a crime against humanity. The WHO is absolutely critical to the not just this pandemic, but attending to the health needs of the Global South and oppressed nations around the world. And you know, to withdraw funding at a time of highest need is inexpressibly criminal. I think the implications, frankly, aren't just for the Global South, but also the repercussions will be felt here. We're not isolated from the Global South, and if this pandemic runs rampant in countries because the WHO lacks the funding to assist in controlling it, that's going to come back to haunt us. It will come back across our borders because of that as well. So this is foolish on every level, not just foolish, but much worse than that. And the question of where we stand and where we go in the wake of this epidemic, I think you're right that the world will be a changed place. I like to think that something the Indian novelist Arundhati Roy wrote gives us a guide to what we need to be doing. She said that the COVID epidemic should open a portal to a better future. And we need to take advantage of the understanding that's been unleashed here about who is valuable, what kind of work is valuable, and who's dispensable in our society in terms of the work they do. To insist and really to mobilize to make sure that our society is fundamentally reoriented. I guess to me, in a way, the symbolism of Goldman Sachs, the giant investment bank, is apropos here. 98% of the employees of Goldman Sachs can telecommute; they can stay at home. But of course, the cleaning personnel for their offices can't telecommute. They're the ones who have to get on the subways and buses in New York, putting their lives at risk to go into work, and they're the ones whose work is absolutely vital. So we need to recognize in every setting how distorted our concepts of value have become in our society, and really address what changes are needed.
Right. Well, on that note, we'll leave it there. But Dr. David Himelstein, we really appreciate your clarity and your taking the time to fill in our listeners in Southern California and across the nation. And we hope to likely we'll have to call on you again. And I'd like to say we really do wish all good things for your daughter, and that she stays safe and healthy, along with, of course, the tens of thousands of people doing that kind of frontline work like she is. Thank you, Dr. David Himelstein.
Thank you.
Okay, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now we're going to be doing something a little bit different with our Earth Watch this week. We are going to be talking with Soren Ambrose, who is the International Head of Policy, Advocacy, and Research for Action Aid International. He's based in Nairobi, Kenya. He was one of the lead organizers of the April 2000 protests against the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, which brought upwards of 20,000 people to Washington, D.C. He has been an activist for global economic justice since 1994. His analyses of the international financial institutions and the global economy have been published and quoted extensively in the U.S. and international media. He was profiled in the Financial Times. Now, in 2007, he became Africa Program Coordinator at the Bank Information Center, a watchdog on international financial institutions. He joined Action Aid International in 2009 to work on development finance. In his various roles, he has been to over 60 countries, seen many types of problems as well as some successes. So, Soren Ambrose, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me on, Margaret.
Okay. Soren, before we begin our discussion, we'll do a blast from your past. All righty, we're going to do a short clip about protests that took place April 2000 against the IMF and World Bank, and this is from C-SPAN.
Brokered to permit a handful of demonstrators to actually march to the World Bank inside the policed wall. As it stands now, authorities have made close to 100 arrests as protesters congregate there on Pennsylvania Avenue. Good afternoon and welcome to our continuing coverage of the World Bank IMF meetings and the protests going on around them. We have team coverage for you from downtown this afternoon. We'll hear from our producer, Melissa Reyes, who is at 20th in Pennsylvania. But first, we want to go to Bruce DuPoit, who is standing by in front of the World Bank building with more on this deal that's been brokered this afternoon. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon. We're directly in front of the two buildings that have been such a focus of attention the last two, three, four, 5 days. The World Bank here, the International Monetary Fund directly behind me. Delegates to the spring meeting of those two organizations coming in early this morning. and getting about their business right on schedule, to the disappointment of some of the demonstrators who had hoped to replicate the battle in Seattle, had hoped they could totally disrupt this function. But it is going on despite the weather and the protests. Most of the demonstrating that we've seen, by a crowd that by most accounts is smaller than the crowd we've seen over the last couple days, protests have been peaceful, though there have been some arrests. For the last couple of hours, we've been monitoring developments just a short distance west of here, adjacent to the George Washington University campus at 20th and Pennsylvania, in that general vicinity, a standoff more or less between a fairly good-sized group of protesters and an equally good-sized group of police.
So, Sarin Ambrose, a blast from your past. You remember those moments. Tell us what you all were hoping to do before we talk about the connection with back then and what's happening today. What you all were hoping to do. More than 20,000 people in Washington, D.C. That's pretty major. Sarin Ambrose.
The idea for the protest was born in Seattle. And of course, the big demonstrations against the World Trade Organization wanted to duplicate or replicate what happened there, that we only had people to organize. The idea was to try to prevent entrance and exit from the beach. We had affinity groups blocking major intersections and entrances to the buildings. It worked on Saturday the 16th. On Sunday the 17th, there was a drenching rain that made it much more difficult, and we eventually had to pack it in because it never did stop raining. We felt that our primary goal of educating the American public about the role of these organizations was indeed accomplished.
Sarin, we do have to fast forward a bit. Looking at, I mean, there was so much kind of anti-globalization protest that went on. There was the Battle of Seattle, of course, that happened, the protests that you helped to organize in Washington, D.C. And now in the age of COVID, you see strong moves by this administration and, you know, in particular, that's a kind of an anti-globalization front. Whether how deep that goes, we really don't know. So there's that issue of a kind of a nationalism setting in. And then there's also the issue of the Global South. You are in Kenya, and from what I understand, the police have really been cracking down pretty heavy on people in Kenya, trying to enforce you know, the stay at home. The last thing I read was about 12 people had died from police action. So, and the last piece, I'd like you to comment on all of these, has to do with then the responsibility of the World Bank and IMF to make sure that developing economies, emerging economies, have the resources that they will undoubtedly need to fight this global pandemic. Sarin Ambrose.
Okay, so the first thing about the Trump administration, they certainly are anti-globalization in some ways. We were not happy. I have a hard time saying I'm happy with anything Trump does, but not unhappy with the cancellation of the Pacific Rim Free Trade Agreement and the general skepticism about trade agreements. In terms of the work on the finance side with the IMF and the World Bank and so on, there has not been anything substantial, just the odd critical tweet from Trump. In terms of Kenya, yes, I'm afraid the police here still exhibit some of the characteristics of a force that started out as a colonial police force, and this is unfortunately common in several African countries, where their first recourse is to violence against those who are not behaving. They have more sophisticated spokespeople who say the police are here to help people, not hurt them. But that message has only reached some of the police, unfortunately. So yes, we do have people who have been injured or killed, and there every night we have a 7 p.m. curfew, and there's a mad rush on the streets of Nairobi, causing, I'm sure, many traffic accidents to try to beat that. In terms of what is happening now, yes, the institutions certainly have that responsibility. In fact, right now, the IMF is holding a press conference. Its main governance body met today, virtually, of course, and we're looking for an announcement about debt relief. We're looking for an announcement about the allocation of the IMF's special currency called special drawing rights, which are cost-free to create, but countries can use for liquidity. This would be one of the most important moves to shore up developing countries' capacity. So far, the U.S. government has been blocking consensus on this because the IMF is a multilateral body. The governments, particularly the rich governments that control it, have to agree. Everyone agrees on the special drawing rights except for the U.S. And I have to say, I can't imagine any economic reason for that other, it's just a matter of spite, I think. However, they have been better on the debt relief. We don't know if they will have cleared that for the IMF, but yesterday the G20 countries did announce a debt relief package, which will give countries some breathing room.
Right, and we did do some coverage of what's called the SDRs and the U.S. blocking it, and let's hope that something could be done about this. And I'm sure our listeners are very interested to know that the United States is in a position of blocking this kind of assistance to emerging economies. Soren, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there, though. I'm sorry about the technical issues with the sound. So perhaps we can talk with you again when we also have a clearer line. We appreciate you taking the time to join us and to see the body of work from protesters with 30,000 people to the work that you're doing now. So we appreciate you taking the time, Soren Ambrose. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me on, Margaret.
And we want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Watch. What we're going to do is take our station break now. Stay with us. Coming up, Deepa Driver on the latest with Julian Assange. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I can't sit and hold. I can't just sit and pray. And that song by John Legend, Preach. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in London, England. And in the United States, a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're now going to turn our attention to Julian Assange and what's going on. We haven't covered this story in a while. Just to give you some background here before welcoming our guest, Julian Assange, of course, made international headlines in 2010 when he released documents and videos that were published by his organization, WikiLeaks. Actually, they were shared with a number of news outlets, including the Washington Post, New York Times, I think The Guardian, and other major newspapers, who then printed them. The information, according to U.S. officials, was provided by U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. She was in prison from 2010 until 2017 when her sentence was commuted. From March 2019 to March 2020, Chelsea Manning was jailed for refusing to testify before a grand jury investigating Julian Assange. She was released just last month, a day after an alleged suicide attempt in jail. Assange's leaks revealed U.S. complicity in the deaths of innocent people during airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Following their release, the U.S. launched a criminal investigation into WikiLeaks directly targeting Julian Assange. He was initially charged with 17 counts under the U.S. Espionage Act. That has now changed with this administration, although they're basically now charging him with one specific charge, but they're definitely interested in him being returned to the United States, and many worry that then additional charges will be slapped on to him. To complicate things, in November 2010, Sweden issued an international arrest warrant for Julian Assange on rape charges, which he has denied. Supporters say the charges were a pretext for him to be extradited to the United States, while others say the women should be believed, but that Assange nevertheless should not be extradited to the United States. Those charges, by the way, have since been dropped. The task of freeing Julian Assange has been taken up by supporters around the world. They say that he's not only been a victim of harassment, but also of torture, because he is a whistleblowing journalist. Julian Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was granted asylum, citizenship, and a place to stay. He was there for 7 years. But then in 2019, Ecuador's new right-wing government revoked his asylum, and British police raided the embassy and arrested Julian Assange. Since then, he's been detained at Belmarsh, a men's prison in the southeast of London, England. And of course, now as COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc in the United Kingdom and around the world, there's increasing concerns about Julian Assange's death, many saying that he should be released. Now, I'm delighted to welcome to Sojourner Truth Deepa Driver. She is based in London. She is a citizen activist campaigning to free WikiLeaks publisher and multi-award-winning journalist Julian Assange. I also have to thank Women Against Rape based in London and based in the UK for their help with this particular segment. Deepa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Margaret. Thanks for having me on.
So, Deepa, tell us the latest now that has happened. I mean, there are concerns about COVID and about Julian Assange's health. Can you tell us anything about that?
I was in court last week at a hearing. It is clear from his lawyers that there are certain really serious issues in relation to Julian's health. Firstly, he has a chronic lung condition since 2012, and as you can imagine, being in prison doesn't help. In British prisons, we have something called the prisoner's cough, which actually gets worse because of the fact that they are old Victorian prisons. The other serious issue, in addition to him having a chronic lung condition, is that his health is very poor due to 10 years of serious psychological torture, as UN rapporteur Professor Neil Smeltzer has reported. Prisons are a very narrow microcosm in that what can happen in prisons is illnesses such as COVID-19 can spread very quickly. And when you are a vulnerable prisoner, you are at greater risk. Julian's lawyers have therefore asked for emergency bail in order that Julian is not sentenced to a death sentence inside Belmarsh prison. Because as you probably know, he is unsentenced, unconvicted prisoner at the moment, so he is on remand. The case of Julian Assange is very, very important for our democracy, because Julian is a journalist, and what the American government is trying to do is to recast journalism as espionage. He's a non-US citizen whom they're seeking to extradite so that he can be tried under US law without First Amendment protections. For journalism, that is not illegal in the states in which he conducted those acts. So it is hugely dangerous, and he is a particularly vulnerable prisoner at the moment in Balmarsh. None of us knows what the long-term effects of torture on the human body are. So torture can create serious physiological damage, and we can see it in a lot in Niels Melzer when he went into the prison with his medical experts to test Julian. It's very clear that Julian is showing a number of the signs and symptoms of severe psychological torture. Julian is also clinically depressed, and as you can imagine, if a prison is in lockdown, the kind of psychological and mental health care support that you would get is very low. If he is not able to talk to his lawyers or to his family or to see them, which means that his mental health conditions are likely to deteriorate. If he wants to use the video room to communicate with his lawyers, there are very few prison staff on duty. In addition, the video room is in a shared space. He's not able to get information through. There are 40,000 pages of documents that he has to read ahead of the extradition, the second part of the extradition hearing in May. Many of those are very complex documents on which he needs legal advice and on which he needs to communicate to his lawyers. He's not able to communicate to his lawyers. They're trying to send things in the post, and it's not even reaching him. This is a complete and utter travesty. It's a show trial, you know, reminiscent of the kind of show trials all over the world in despotic states, where a journalist and a publisher is being treated with utter contempt and is treated in a horrific way. And we must all stand together to oppose this, because what is happening to Julian is the canary in the coal mine. Other journalists are next. Anyone who is critical of U.S. foreign policy, of U.S. war crimes abroad, is in the same position. If you complain about environmental regulations, if you complain about other things, if you are a whistleblower, your life is likely to be at risk, because what they are doing to Julian Assange is likely to happen to you next. So I urge people around the world to come together to support Julian.
Yes, absolutely. And over 30,000 people around the world have signed an online petition calling for his release. I'm sure listeners would be able to find this petition online. Also, on March 25th, Julian Assange was denied bail after his lawyers said he should be released because of what you say, Deepa, about his vulnerability to COVID. But a judge has also rejected the request for an adjournment of Assange's extradition hearing in May until September. Now, this is being reported by The Guardian. And Deepa, you have been part of that movement. And it's interesting that the very publications who took the information from Julian and who published it, a number of them are now bashing Julian Assange and denying his work as a journalist. Your thoughts?
Yes, certainly. I think Julian's case is a very complex one. In 2010 and thereabouts, when he started revealing U.S. war crimes, a lot of people were basking in the reflected glory while not wanting to take the kinds of risks that WikiLeaks takes in order to reveal information that helps us to hold our governments to account for crimes they commit in our name. And a number of what's interesting is that this has gone through a little bit of a bell curve, in that people started off being very fond of Julian and using his skills, wanting to hang out with him, participate in parties that he held, and then slowly what they started to do was distance themselves from him and suddenly say, oh, you're not a journalist, but we are, which is quite interesting, because what we see of mainstream journalism today is essentially journalists filtering information, manipulating information, misrepresenting information, which is, you know, which we all know happens all the time. And what Julian was doing was providing unfiltered information for people to make up their own minds, because that's what we need to do. We need to be able to understand what's really going on, and of course we want comment and opinion from intelligent and thoughtful journalists, but we also want to know the truth without being deprived of information. So that's what Julian did. And one of the things I wanted to mention and just highlight is Julian has never been charged in relation to the Swedish allegations. The investigations were always at preliminary investigation stage, which meant that Julian was never able to come to court to either, you know, to give justice to the women or justice to him, because he could never fight a case in court because the investigations were never taken past that stage. The Swedish investigators tried several times to close the case, and what is really criminal is the role of the British Crown Prosecution Service in trying to keep that case open. One of the things they said was, don't you dare get cold feet. This is what they said in writing, in exact words, to their Swedish counterparts. This is not being treated like any other extradition. So when you start seeing this, what you then see is the weaponization of positive ideals. Many of us feel very strongly about sexual abuse, about crimes against women. And with the Swedish allegations, what you see is the weaponization of positive ideals, a sense of kinship that we feel with women who have been wronged, and a desire to trust them, that is then weaponized towards negative ends, which is to shut down journalism and shut down democracy. So the women in Sweden, their statements were changed. One of their statements was changed. Their information was leaked to the press. Information was put in the public domain about the case, which was not entirely correct, which was actually actively wrong. And this kind of thing led to a phony culture of somewhat what I would say identity politics, which was people who didn't know very much of the case, all of them said, oh, he's been charged in Sweden. If you were a proper journalist, you would know he's never been charged. But a number of so-called proper journalists repeated this kind of smear. And because, you know, once you hear a smear, what happens is you tend to take it on board and you associate what you hear with this individual, which then distances Julian and anybody who is under this kind of smear from the very public whose support they need and in whose interests they are revealing the war crimes.
Deepa, I'm afraid we only have just about 30 seconds or so left.
Sure.
You know, we'll have to return to this. But given Julian's situation now, there have been a number of webinars, coming up in the U.S., I know a global one that took place. People are definitely still mobilizing. So for people who want to support your efforts, the efforts around Julian Assange not being extradited, what would you suggest they do?
I think there are two things. One, politically, please contact your MPs or your members of parliament, your senators, and please take an active stance in defense of Julian. Secondly, please educate yourself as to the facts. There is a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media. Please do not repeat the smears and the lies. Thirdly, please remember that it is very easy to think that our voice doesn't count, that somebody else will do this.
Yeah.
But if we don't stand up together and we don't show solidarity, tomorrow, next, it will be us.
Right. I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there because I have to be out for the next show. But we appreciate you, Deepa Driver, for joining us. I'd like to thank the Sojourner
Margaret,
Truth.
And the Twitter handle is @Deepa_Driver in case anybody wants to follow me on the latest updates on Julian.
Okay. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our audio engineer, Kiana Williams, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. Thank you for listening. And stay safe.
Glory, ha, glory, hallelujah. Sometimes I'm up.
Good morning, Portland. You're listening to KBOO on 90.7 FM, K282BH in Philomath on 104.3 FM, and on K22HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. And now for your local weather. Sunshine returns today, creating our warmest day of the week and tying the warmest day of April so far. High pressure will hold across the Pacific Northwest today with a sunny start to the day around the entire region. Expect daytime highs to soar into the mid-70s around 75 degrees here for only the second time this month. Overnight, skies will turn partly cloudy as an onshore flow takes hold. Overnight lows will be near 48 degrees. Marine clouds will be around much of the day tomorrow. The clouds will be deep enough to create some drizzle or showers in the region. After possible dampness on Saturday, Sunday will also begin cloudy. However, the afternoon will be clearing to partly cloudy skies. Highs will be in the low 60s. The warmer trend will continue through Tuesday, with a chance of cooler weather and showers by the middle of next week. Stay tuned. More of KBOO here on 90.7 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, KBOO will be sticking to our regularly scheduled programming as much as possible, but there are some limitations that we're working with, so we appreciate your understanding and support. We are committed to keeping our staff, volunteers,